Hey, everybody. Welcome to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Aid.
And we're here to talk about Far From Home, the second episode of Discovery's third season.
This is the movie with Electro, right?
Yeah, that's not that movie, no. I kind of would rather have watched that movie. We have a little bit of Star Trek news. We got word that Picard's third season is now guaranteed, right?
Well, they haven't announced that it's going into production. It was one of those things when it's a Hollywood industry magazine saying that they're doing pre-production work on it.
Okay, yeah.
Which is pretty much like tantamount to like getting people and assets lined up to start working on season three while season two is in whatever state of production they're currently in.
And this shouldn't surprise us because we already know that Star Trek's got like a plan all the way out to 2027, but it's still encouraging. I like Discovery, and it's nice to see it get green. I like Picard. It's nice to see it get greenlit for a third season.
Hopefully, we'll be able to see some threads go through the seasons. If they can guarantee that we've got a season two and a season three, we won't just go, "Oh, finish up season two, and then we'll think of a new story for season three." That'd be nice.
And in many ways, that first season of Picard was very self-contained.
Yeah.
It would be nice if they can kind of make it more of a ongoing thing. And yeah, that's true. All right, so we have. Let's very quickly recap the plot of Far From Home. We left off at the end of last episode with the knowledge that Discovery was separated from Burnham. We didn't know where Discovery was or when Discovery was. It shows up. I'm interested in all the different ways that Star Trek shows the effects of time travel on the crew ever since the first one in Star Trek 4. Or not the first one. That's not the first one. But I remember in Star Trek 4 when they go through time and we get that weird, like...
Well, the very first one is in, like, the naked time when they go back in time by accident. And all it is it's the little clock. It's the little... the 1960s clock that's counting up and just counts down. Okay. Like the clock knows it's going backwards, and that's how they do it. They have some like trippy music.
Well, here the crew are unconscious, similar to the way that the bridge crew are affected by time travel in Star Trek IV. They all wake up and just in time to crash on this new planet. And Detmer kind of saves the day. Flies the ship to a intact landing. Any landing you can walk away from is a good landing. But she's clearly injured, and then the plot is about making contact. They need repairs. They have to repair their communications. They can't do that without a special element, and that element is at a nearby outpost. So Saru takes takes Tilly. I would have liked to have seen some Killy. That I'm Freudian slipping here to future in the show. Saru and Tilly head to that outpost where they meet some people that are barely holding on and surviving. Star Trek aliens, by which I mean human except for bumps on their forehead. And while they're negotiating and getting their repairs, a courier shows up similar to the other couriers that we've seen in the first episode, like Book and the others. And he's like their supply guy. He comes from the exchange, the place that we saw in the first episode, with supplies every once in a while. And they give him everything they have. And he's apparently killed several of them already. You had this great name that you called him, Aid, in our outline, Pirate Pete.
Pirate Pete, yeah. I can't remember what his name
was. Pirate Pete's just going to be what we call him.
Yeah. So Pirate Pete shows up with about half a dozen mooks. And they kill one of the guys at this outpost. After torturing him, and Saru and Tilly are basically at this guy's mercy until suddenly Giorgio appears, having followed Tilly and Saru all the way out here, and she proceeds to first allow them to torture her, then kick their asses. They make peace with the survivors. They kick. Saru has this interesting moment where rather than punish Pirate Pete, he gives Pirate Pete's fate to the locals to decide. So they kick him out into the ice. and then there's a couple of subplots with Stamets, with Stamets and a couple of other things going on. But eventually we fix the ship and everybody gets back to the ship and we're trying to lift off as the ice encrusts around the ship when another vessel appears, tractors them out, and of course it's Burnham. And apparently it's been a year. Is that right? A year has passed.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got her new hairdo. And we know nothing else about her situation. But the crew is back.
We don't even see the ship.
Do we see the ship?
No, we don't even see if it's booked ship or anything. We've got no idea what it is. Yeah.
Which I think they're saving on purpose, so we'll get to that. All right, so that's, you know, that's the plot, such as it is. Okay, so what were your thoughts? Abe, you want to start us off?
Okay, so this one definitely seems to take another step towards Firefly territory. We've even got space western doors on the area they go into. Yeah. It's really standing to that. They're well built a little bit. We are now. It seems that the exchange from season episode one is not just a one off thing. It seems to almost be a complete hub to the entire situation at the moment. The characters are moving, or the couriers are moving, obviously through this section of space, yeah. And they are integral to the survival of everyday settlements out there, because obviously the Federation's not out there to do anything about it. Yeah. So that's okay, fair enough. It'd be interesting to see how long that keeps up and whether or not that's a thing, because again, dilithium can only take you so far, and warp is only as fast as it is. I mean, we all know it takes, you know, days and days and days to get some time locations, so they must have died off if they haven't got anybody nearby. But all in all, it was all right, again, but they used so many of the standard technology's not working, can't contact each other, everyone's trapped under ice, oh okay, and lots of putting for, you know, creative ways, in quotation marks, creative ways of getting the situation to go get underhand so that everyone's on their back foot. Because again, like we mentioned before, why Tilly and Saru go? Why not send the apparently at least some of the black shielded security guys that were in the very first episode of the scene, because apparently Discovery had a massive security prints on it because it was a spore drive ship. Why do we send five of those guys around with them? Why do we just send two people out there into space, into a random settlement? Why does the communications device need the ship to actually function when technically anything, according to the technical manuals, it only needs to do that if it's going from Earth to the orbit. They should work like walkie-talkies. You should be able to contact from A to B. Right. So they should be able to contact each other. It shouldn't be a problem at all. But apparently this thing, you pull the plug out, literally a plug, out the side of the ship, and then all the communications break all in one go. And you go, oh, that was terrible.
Yeah.
So the idea of it crashing and it being trapped under ice is not a bit bad thing, but... And again, like we mentioned in the notes, sending in ice, they don't mention if it's, oh, it's another life form. We need to study this. We just nuke the crap out of it. There's just so much stuff they discarded.
Hey, save some of this for later, man.
No, it's crazy. There's just so much stuff in it that just seems to be like, oh, this is the bit they create. This is the bit they create a new life form. No, that's just discarded.
To Abe's defense, this is what the pacing of the episode does. It brings up all of these ideas,
yeah,
and then it just disposes them as quickly as possible. This is Discovery at its worst.
Yeah.
Discovery at its worst has pacing problems. Well, nothing is allowed to breathe.
Yeah.
We get very few character moments, of which all the character moments we got in this episode, I actually quite liked. But everything else is just plot, 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 plot. We get a problem that is introduced and then is taken care of in the line of dialogue. Holistically speaking, as much as the last episode won me over and I was singing the praises and I was really looking forward to it, this episode lost me.
Some of those character hooks as well don't go anywhere. That's what's so weird about it. Because again, we get the Stamets and Jet. That at least goes somewhere. That we see a little bit they're coming through. We see obviously the Doctor coming in and helping out, but the stuff with Giorgio and the guy you can see in eight, whatever, me and Fields of Vision or whatever, that just kind of pops up. So theoretically, that's going to be tantalized somewhere else. Detmer on the brig. What's going on with her? What's her trauma? There's not even any. She doesn't even mostly speak for the entire episode. She just wandered around looking lost. She's like, are you going to actually acknowledge what the problem is? Let's go.
When I try to write an outline, aid to kill him. Like, we'll get to all this. We'll get to all those. You brought up a bunch of things that we all want that we're going to hit. So let. One thing was one thing at a time. I'm going to jump in real quick just to give my personal overview of the episode, which is that I didn't like it. And I felt like the episode showed all the bridge crew at their worst. Saru watches innocent people get tortured and killed, and he stands there with Tilly. Stamets is supposed to – we're supposed to think he's heroic for doing this repair in the Jeffrey's tube that a child could have done. Like, it was literally like, okay, take this strappy thing off, unplug this thing, put in a new strappy thing, put the plug thing back in. The only reason why that was at all heroic is because he was so arrogant that he had made the problem difficult for himself. I mean, any ensign could have gone up there and done that in 2 minutes, right?
We could have had Gene the Janitor.
Yeah.
That was introduced in that. It'll be like, hey, just go up there, man.
Put the broom down.
Stop cleaning up Leland. Get up there and fix this.
Detmer walks out of the sick bay, lets her walk out, clearly still effed up. I have theories on all of these things because I'm an optimist and I want to see all of these plots turn into something good later on down the road in future episodes. So I'm hoping that this was all just like set up or shit that they want to do. But I was really disappointed by it. Like, this was not a good time for me. Okay, but let's get to some of the specific things that you guys wanted, that we all wanted to talk about. Okay, let's start with Saru. He's the captain, the acting captain. Jim, Aide, why is he still acting captain?
I was wondering that. Why do they call him Captain Saru? Why do they keep calling him Commander? It's like, well, you're a captain now, mate. You're in charge of the ship. There's no one to give you a...
Is he not captain?
He's not. So what happens at the end of season two is right before the final episode where they don't have the time to do anything except blow things up. Pike stands there and he's about to, like every good captain that we've seen since Colk, say, okay, you're the captain now. I'm leaving. I'm going on the Enterprise to help you as support. There was a moment where Saru and Bonham look at each other as two ranking commandos and they say, we'll decide the captain issue later. So that's why he becomes acting captain. He takes the chair and it hasn't been codified because he has to have a conversation with Bonham as to who's going to actually be the captain of the Discovery.
So you had some thoughts on Saru's stuff parts in this episode. You want to talk
about? I actually liked, there was a couple scenes that worked for me in this episode. So yeah. I'm trying to, like, I knew I was going to write like a page of these are the things I didn't like.
Yeah, yeah.
After the episode finished, like my wife and I just looked at each other and we're like, this is not good. And then I just went on for like an hour. So like why it was not good.
Thanks, Thanks, Misty, for doing all that.
And she was chiming in too. So I knew I wasn't completely off base. But I quite like the scene in the captain's ready room. We see all of Pike's things shadowed about. His pottery and whatnot is in the background busted up. And it's Saru, Giorgio, Nan, and Tilly. And I quite like that scene because it's Saru standing up for himself.
Yeah.
Like it's Saru actually taking control of the situation and telling the person he respects, or at least the likeness of the person that he respects the most, the person who came to his home planet. And brought him to this intergalactic society so he can live his best life, and telling him no. And then a moment later, when Saru and Tilly are walking, this is sort of an extension of that scene, he has the emotional intelligence to be able to relate to the Empress and say, okay, she's upset about Bonham, but she can't quite comprehend these emotions.
Yeah.
And we have a wonderful discussion with the two of them about feel and emotions and when is it okay to entertain these things, and when is it okay to turn them off for the purpose of the greater good?
Yeah,
Yeah. And I quite like those moments. And anytime Wilson Cruz and Anthony Rapp were in the same room together on screen, I was like, okay, great. Give me more of this. I want this show.
Yeah, we'll get to the Stamets bit in a bit because I had some thoughts on that too.
Thoughts on that too? Now you've said like Saru not actually being brought up to captain, I think we are seeing a Burnham captaincy on the horizon. Because who would want to say, well, you can't rank Burnham up there with all the other great Starship captains if she's not captain, can she? So she needs to be captain because all the other captains got, you know, when you do the whole Paramount flag of everybody in it, it's always the captains and you can't have just a sub commander or whatever on the, yeah, so that's it. So I think she's going to be captain of the Discovery. I quite like the way Saru's character has changed since he lost his fear gland thingies and they've turned into those little needle shooters. But again, like you say, it's the bits where he's standing there waiting for people to get shot and it's just like, okay. There's a nice stuff between him and Tilly as they're walking along and they're chatting away and he kind of explaining fear because, again, to him, it's his entire civilization is built on fear. So the idea he kind of says, okay, this is what I've learned since that time. You know, you acknowledge it, you snap it down and you carry on kind of thing.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, he's still one of my favorite characters. I still think he's still that kind of, he fulfills that Data Doctor slot in Discovery because there's not many of those characters that kind of stand out. You get some people that have got some weird stuff going on that makes them different. I mean, old Mr. Eyes is another character we've obviously not seen before. Whether or not he's going to be interesting, we don't know. But yeah, he's still pretty cool. But yeah. I don't know. There's not much else I can say what he did because, again, it's just like he didn't do anything particularly overly heroic. He just carried on doing his Saru talky thing and, yeah.
I love the bit where he tells Tilly that he brought her along because she's really good at first impressions. Like, I like that, and I thought that was a neat character moment. But I have never warmed. I liked Saru as a character. But from the very beginning in the first season, I wondered why the hell would Starfleet make an officer out of a guy who's biologically programmed to be afraid of everything? And I struggle with that a lot. Now, of course, they fix that, as Aide, you already alluded to the scene, right, where he sort of sheds his fear impact, his fear glands. But his pacifism in this episode just really grated on me. And I swear to God, if he says, yes, we're in deep trouble, but we're all in this together one more time, I'm going to punch him in the gills. and it's not even his fault. It's the writer's fault. Like it's not Saru. It's not the character. It's not the actor. Doug Jones is he's brilliant. He's a national treasure, but they need to write that character better because him standing around with Tilly as a guy gets tortured and shot, it is terrible. Like, you guys are Starfleet officers, man. You know, find your backbone. And I, that's why I said at the beginning of the episode when I slipped that I called her Killy, because I wanted to see a little bit of that Captain Killy come out, you know? And this is another thing that I'm hoping that maybe we can set up. Like, my hope is that the writers are looking at season 3 and thinking, okay, we need arcs for these characters. We need arcs. And for them to get somewhere that we want them to be, they have to start off somewhere we don't want them to be. And it's about changing from A to B. Like, how do they go from where we don't like them to where we do like them, right? And Saru being really passive and Tilly being terrified of everything and Stamets being a complete arrogant asshole that almost gets himself killed. And all of these, and poor Detmer, you know, who we'll get to. All of these things I'm hoping are setups for seasons, episodes we're going to see throughout the season. I don't know if we'll get there or not.
Well, this is the thing, like I said last time, the idea that half these characters only really got names in season 2.
That's right.
It's kind of just, it's like, you want me to care about these characters that I saw her fly the ship for an entire season and no one called her by her bloody name?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, okay.
And I actually have been really interested in watching those background characters become more fleshed out. All right, so, but let's I can't chide you guys about the outline and leave it myself. So let's go back. Let's talk about this, the Stamets scenes. Thoughts on Stamets and his whole plot line. Yeah, Jamie, you were saying that you enjoyed seeing him on with the dog.
I enjoyed the beginning.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed when it was Wilson Cruz smiling in the camera saying, "You're alive and I love you," and all of that stuff, the little kisses and the "you're gonna stay here for one cycle." All of that setup,
yeah,
like all of that opening character stuff to be like, okay, we're done with the will they won't they plot point of season two.
Right.
They're a couple.
Yeah.
And we're gonna work it out. And those things about both characters that they don't quite understand yet, so they don't quite, you know, they don't like any couple. Like you have that thing where I'm like, I can understand and empathize with you, but I still don't like it. Like kind of thing. So I like that, but then it gets just to the Jet Reno deadpan delivery joke fest, and the machismo, "I'm gonna do this because I'm a man, I guess." And your back's thrown out, but you somehow got from the bridge to engineering. Like, no one helped you move downhill. Like, I don't understand. I don't know. I just.
They were literally the worst two people out of an 8-man crew to send into a Jeffrey's tube.
Yeah.
It's like, you got a stomach and chest wound. You got a shitty back. You're the two that's going to go in a Jeffrey's cube. Oh, yeah, that's great on it. Yeah, it's just a weird thing. Yeah.
It was such a weird battle. Then they established later in the episode those 77 people who are not injured.
Yes.
On the Discovery.
Yes.
There's a bunch of people who could help out with this.
Okay.
Exactly. And we're supposed to be in this together, but Stamets is going to die because he's crawling around showing his machismo.
There was a bunch of people that could have gone with Saru and Tilly, but they didn't. They were set. It's like, what have you got to do? Send them out. Again. But this is what fundamentally, like I said before, the idea of limiting your crew. Again, talking the role-playing game situations, you've got to come to that situation where the five players you've got are the five most important players because the other 70 members of the crew, they're doing something else.
Yeah.
So, we've got to take these Klingons on. How many Klingons are there? Five, right? Okay, one-on-one. Okay. No, let's call the other 75 people in. We just kick the crap out of them. That's it. No one ever does that. You have to think of a reason to do it. And this is the problem we're doing it. It's kind of like, it's very similar to like a James Bondy kind of thing, and always like you've got, you know, take the head guy out and we've got everybody do it, but it always just relies on one guy to do it. It's like, we'll just send a big name, more people in there. It's the same as Khan in the second movie. It's like, oh, well, there's a lot of this stuff going on there, but it turns out to be a fist fight between the people. And you've got, but you've got an entire Enterprise crew. Everyone could just beam down there and kick the shit out of him. It makes no sense. So,
he's got to open his shot,
That's true.
On Twitter, you made this observation about a different topic. It wasn't about this episode, where you compared something to the Fantastic Four film, where the Fantastic Four cause a problem on the bridge on the which bridge was it in New York? I forget.
The Brooklyn Bridge.
Brooklyn Bridge. They cause this huge problem on the Brooklyn Bridge, and then they get celebrated for fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
This is Stamets in this goddamn episode. Like, he causes his own pain, and then he gets treated like a hero. Or I shouldn't say he gets treated, because the crew doesn't care. But we, the audience, are expected to cheer for him because he fixed a problem of his own making. I actually don't think it's machismo. Stamets doesn't strike me as a guy who's particularly – it's not particularly important to him to prove that he's manly. I don't know if he's ever – but he has an intellectual arrogance that makes him think that he's – the best in any situation.
I think the two engineers spurn each other on. I think that's the thing. I think each one's trying to outdo the other. It's like if there was two Scotties on the Enterprise, each one would be trying to fix the different crystal chamber before the other one did it. So it's that kind of thing.
He's self-real. His thing is that he's afraid to need other people. Right? This is Stamets' issue. And so he wants to do everything by himself, right? So this is why when Reno, is that her name, Reno?
Yeah.
Reno's like, she's going to go with him. And he's like, I do this by myself. And she's like, well, then I guess I'll just follow along and give moral support. He has to do everything by himself. And this is what gets him into trouble. And again, I'm hoping that we're establishing that now so that his boyfriend can say, listen, you have to stop doing this to yourself. You need to realize that you need other people. I'm going to quote the captain out. We're all in this together, right? I just want to punch him in the chest even when he says that. But anyway.
The thing with Stamets, though, Stamets went through the ringer a lot in season two.
He did.
And it's like, okay, you've already proved yourself. You've jumped to multiple dimensions. You've done this. You've done that. You've injected yourself with a spore drive thing. We know you can do it, mate. You don't have to go in a Jeffrey Shoe. Get let someone else do it. It's fine. So, yeah.
Okay. Detmer. Can we talk about Detmer?
We've lost Jim.
Hopefully he'll come back. You had some thoughts on what's going on with Detmer, or was it just a question, Ed?
Yeah, no, I like the character. This is the thing. Yeah. I like the character. I think she's a cool character. She was always, again, she's got the kind of the cybernetic thing on her head. So when she sat on the bridge of the original ship, you go, right, there's something interesting to this character. We don't know her name yet because we're not going to do anything like that. So where is it going to be? And obviously she became, again, more prevalent in season two when the cyborg other character was taken over by Control and destroyed. Yeah. You can see they were kind of like, at least had a, there was a friendship going on between all those characters actually on the bridge.
Yeah.
And then this episode, just like, oh, she took a knock to the head. Okay, what's happening now? Right, she goes to med bay. Right, she gets it fixed. She comes out. She wanders around like she's totally traumatized.
Yeah.
What's going on? Why? Now, you said you had theories. My theory, again, because you've got the cybernetic thing in it, is she carrying something over from Control in her own head and that's why she's traumatized? Is it something we're trying to drag over from season two to make it, you know, like the big bad in season three? Or are we not going for the big bad in season three? Are we just going to, you know, trying to bring the Federation together? I don't know. But I'm really hoping there's something going on there because there's a lot of screen time, literally, for something that in the original TV series and movies, they go to sick bay. They go to sick bay. They come back later on 5 minutes later and go, are you okay? Yes, I'm fine. And they sit back in their chair. It's just such a weird thing.
Bobcat, thoughts on Detmer?
So those a couple things living inside the Discovery computer.
Okay.
We've got the Sphio data, which is it has a sense of sentience. Like it has self-preservation. It takes over Discovery when the Enterprise tries to blow it up from a distance. It shuts down the auto-destruct. There was that. The Sphio data has some sort of agency in the computer.
And oddly enough, not mentioned at all. No one goes, the ship's about to, we're going to lose all power. Is the Sphio data okay? No one mentions it. They just don't even give a crap.
No one mentions the Sphio data. The Sphio data is there. And also, Alien's memories are still in the computer.
Yes.
All of them except for the very last memory, which is uploaded to her right before she dies. But she saved her entire back catalog of the memories that she kept that mattered to her. So that's living in the computer. And we know that at some point, Discovery will gain sentience and become Zora.
Right. Right.
So we know that there's something going on. And I don't know if Detmer is supposed to play a part in that, or if, as Abe points out, she's an extension of Control, and maybe Leland has found a way to survive his explosion and stomp through the head.
Okay, here's where my money is. I don't think any of that shit. I don't think her situation has anything to do with Discovery's computer or any of the information in it at all. I think this is the writers talking about stuff we've noticed in the first couple of episodes, which is the advanced technology of the 33rd century. Are we in the 33rd century?
Yeah, something like that.
We've got personal transporters. We've got programmable matter we see in this episode, right? Where like he's like basically creating the tool out of nanotechnology. And Tilly's like, that's really cool. And he's like, how come you don't know what this is? This is like basic shit, right? How can we show advanced technology in the bridge crew? Answer, the one bridge crew member who is a cyborg.
Mm-hmm.
This is a power-up plot. She's biologically fine. The doctors give her the once-over. But her implant has been fucked so that we have to replace it. And we replace it with some 33rd century new tech that's going to give her new powers. Yeah. And I think, and maybe that's just my gamified version of what's going on, because I've seen so many radiation accidents in various campaigns where a player's like, I want to get a new power and I have all these experience points to spend and how do I rationalize it? and like I want to power up, right? But that's what I think is going on. And I think that she's gonna struggle. It probably will get resolved relatively quickly. Because her wandering around in a trance half the time is not only really uninteresting to the audience, it's gotta be really uninteresting to the actress. Like it's just kind of boring. It's a boring plot. Because there's no obvious peril. She's just obviously messed up. So it's kind of a suspense thing, I guess. Well, how long can we play that along before she gets fixed? And then we make the fix the plot. Like, okay, she's got this new technology. She doesn't really understand it. And we start to explore the cyborg nature of her character a little bit more with her learning how to, now she's a Lobot or whatever. And we learn about, you know, we get some stories out of that. That's what I'm hoping. If it's Control, I give up, man.
Well, just before we leave Detmold, yeah. I just want to comment. One of the things I didn't like is, like you said, you're going to punch Saru in the throat for the, we'll end this together.
Yeah.
He gives a speech about, you know, wanting, like, there was a couple things. I knew we were in for bad times at Ridgemont High when Tilly's like, I can't figure out what time it is. And I'm just thinking, well, if you're on the same planet that you're supposed to be on, you took scans of that planet. Carbon dating's still a thing. Take a tricoder, scan the planet, and figure out where you're at. Like, it's not that difficult. Like, I don't want to be gamifying the story, but during that scene, he gives a speech about how we're all in it together, and we're not going to be worried about what's on the outside because the solutions are here. We need to get for them. And then no one escorts Detmold to sickbay. Like, this is a thing that Discovery does. Like, in the opening episode of the show, that Connell kid, who's like a helmsman or a navigator, gets blown up, and Georgiou just says, go to sickbay. And no one on the bridge, none of those background extras are available to, like, just walk them to sickbay. Like, that guy would still be alive if he had gone to sickbay and not accidentally shown up in the brig. And, like, Detmold, like, everyone's looking at her like she's like, they're really concerned about her. And I would be concerned about it, but no one's actually doing anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, oh, I'm sorry that you're having a headache kind of a look, as opposed to you just saved all of our lives because you were awesome. And now you have a serious problem. So I'm going to stop whatever it is I'm doing because we're in this together and help you out.
I don't ask for a lot from my Star Trek, but I want the Starfleet officers to be fucking competent. Right. Like, I want them. And there was a lot of incompetence on display in this episode, and it was really dysfunctional. And I get that that's a thing. They want to make the show, they want to make the crew dysfunctional. I want to show that. Okay. But I was not wild about it.
See, with Georgiou, it's not such a big thing because Georgiou technically is the outsider.
So it's not
a problem. They've published Starfleet operations manuals since the fucking 70s or whatever. You know, you read a bloody book, for Christ's sake. If it says, you know, standard procedure to an injured crew member is to escort them to medbay, put that scene in there. It's just like they don't want to write these things because it's the same as we've seen many in episodes in the past where just one line would at least say, right, you've acknowledged it, and that's it. And it takes like nanoseconds to say that line. But when they don't do it, everyone goes, well, why do she could just walk out the door and fall over and no one would ever find her for 20 minutes. It's just like, why has no one done that? It just makes no sense. So it didn't have to be a main crew member. It could just be a supporting cast member just to put, yeah, okay, let's go. And that's it. That'd be fine.
So we started here with Georgiou. A, did you have thoughts on her role in this episode?
Georgiou is exactly as I said last time. She's the marquee. She's Seska from Voyager. Okay, this is what it's going to be. She's going to be constantly undermining whoever's in charge. Yeah, we can kick the shit out of the crap. The thing I'm kind of annoyed about with her in the fact that her concern for Burnham, this is not her Burnham. This is mirror universe to her Burnham. So the idea that she can, like, well, you look like the Burnham I knew, that's good enough for me. Just seems to be like, yeah, I'm willing to stomp over everything else, but because you look like my Burnham, that's okay. If it was a time travel plot and she was like, they could go back and save her Burnham, or if it was like, this is my Burnham. But the idea is like, well, you don't even live up to my expectations of Burnham. My Burnham was stronger than you because she wouldn't take any crap. Yeah, you're Federation Burnham. You're a substandard version of Burnham. That seems to be a weird thing. I also don't understand why she followed Saru to the settlement, apart from the idea she can kung fu everybody in the canteen. What was the point in that? Unless she was literally just trying to assert her authority again and say, well, yeah, she's not even there to like say, well, I'm here to rescue you. It's like, why did you actually turn up? The one thing I will say is because it was Michelle Yeoh, the fight scenes are pretty cool.
Yeah,
I'm glad they slowed them down and didn't do the usual thing where everything's really, really fast and they pan the camera and she can't see who's fighting, because Michelle Yeoh did those moves. So the idea that she did not do half that stuff is just, that's cool as well. But I think Georgia as a character is either going to become irritating because she's constantly going to be coming, oh, well, I'm not going to do that, and just stomping around doing her own thing, or she's going to be left behind. And let's say they've said about Section 31 story with her season with her in it. Is she going to go back? Is it going to be her establishing doing something else in this timeline? It seems, I don't know.
Jim?
I hate it.
I hated it, and I
like Michelle Yeoh. And there's nothing against. Again, none of my comments are geared towards the actors.
Given
substandard material, I don't think the material was well thought out enough. We have three scenes where Michelle Yeoh nags people, and it's nagging the same people. There was the scene where she shows up and she's covered in Leland. It's the corridor scene that they just established that the communications plug is unplugged and they need to fix it.
Yeah.
And this colony just so happens to have the one material that we need. And in this scene is Tilly and Non shows up, and that's continued into the captain's ready room scene. And I liked it as a Saru scene, but as a General Joe scene, it's whole hitting the same points that she hit in the corridor. And then Non's in that scene. Non's left on the ship. There's another corridor scene that includes a turbo lift and an introduction to Linus scene. And all she's doing is the same thing. I'm just going to keep nagging on people until people give me what I want or they don't look at me anymore. And when Linus showed up, I was super happy. I'm like, oh, it's Linus. Like, I had the same emotional joy I had, you know, when I was a kid and like Wolf would show up in season one, because, you know, Wolf wasn't main, you know, he was on the bridge every now and then, but he wasn't a main character until, you know, Hall of Glory, and they started codifying him more into the show. But I had that same emotional high of, oh, it's Linus. And then we get this weird scene where they're talking about his eyes. Yeah. And he talks about his superpower and how he can see whatever the exposition was. And then he just vanishes. Like, he vanishes from the whole episode. Does JoJo eat his eyeballs? Like, I don't understand why that was established.
She clearly wants him to look at something, right? Or look for something.
And the other thing, the idea that she goes off with Linus and they kind of like she disappears, and then for some reason an ensign is sent down to see Stamets because, oh, she said she was coming here. Oh, she's not here then. Okay, bye. It's like, what? Why would you have that bit in it? It just seemed like a weird thing. And again, as we just mentioned, you can't escort Deppner off the bridge, but you can go running around after Giorgio down a couple of decks to find it. Oh, she's not here. She's a commander. She doesn't have to report in.
Makes Non look totally incompetent.
Yeah.
I don't really have too much to add as far as Giorgio goes. Like, I agree with what you guys are saying. I love watching. I will happily watch Michelle Yeoh kick a dozen people's asses. Like, that's a good time. Okay. But I'm going to gamify her for a minute, because what I was struck by as I was watching it, Giorgio's got a trait on her character sheet that says when she takes damage, she gets more powerful. And she knows she has it. So that's why she lets the guys torture her, so that she can build up her buffs before she unloads on them. And what's great about it is that it's very appropriate to the Mirror Universe, where there's agonizers.
Like, exactly.
People in the Mirror Universe would have this trait. Like, okay, I'm so used to pain that it just really pisses me off, and I use it to attack with. And if we were ever to do like a Mirror Universe character generation thing, that would be one of the traits that would be available for players from that setting to pick, is the one that lets them get more powerful when they take damage.
Can we unbox that scene a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
So for me, I don't want to keep, like, I know Discovery is not TOS. I know it's not Next Generation. I know it's not Bowman Trek or Roddenberry Trek. But the scene where she's getting shot over and over again by the gun being ramped up in settings, the Tonchal scene. Yeah. If this was TOS, Kulk would have three people on him, holding him down, and then someone punches him in the gut.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Like, oh, he would say something at the very least. Like, if he's, like, Game Stores of Triskelion, he's in a separate room while Hull's being attacked. His arm is shooting through those balls. He is reaching for camera. He is doing anything he can. He knows it's totally futile, but his crewman's in danger. This is someone who's under his care.
Yeah.
Saru should be more upset, and instead it's being played up as a foreplay line, which I even said it, like, right before she says it, like, when she gets shot the first time, he starts wrapping it up. Oh, this is just the foreplay scene. And she says it almost beat by beat the way I said it too. And I was like, okay, fine. But the fact that Saru is, like, completely passive in this one moment, after seeing what the gun can do,
yes,
is just beyond the pale for me. Like, I get that they were threatening violence against Tilly, and that's why Tilly sort of quieted down, because he was talking all about, you gotta go walk in here and maybe you'll survive the ice parasite, which we haven't even mentioned.
We'll get to
45 minutes in here, and like the episode itself, we haven't even talked about the ice alien.
Yeah.
The breathing problem issue, is that tied to the ice alien? So the threatening violence with Tilly, and I get why she wouldn't do it, because she's not a captain. She's an ensign. She's probably 22 years old. She's young. Like, I get that the reason why she's not going to make a scene, but
she also just survived the ship crash as well. So yeah.
And Saru has a superpower. Like, he's got like an attack thing that has no time. It's like a quick response action.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, and apparently, it knocks the person down. You know, it's strong enough to, like, take out the bad guy. Like, it doesn't keep him down, but it at least takes him out of, like, for a round or two.
I would have looked, okay, we've set up in terms of plot that there's half a dozen dudes with guns and they're more powerful physically than Saru and Tilly. And so there's nothing that Saru and Tilly can do. But when that innocent guy is being shot and then killed, I would have loved to have seen Saru and Tilly have a reaction like you just described. Like, you know, Saru and Tilly try and do something and the pirates, like, grab them and beat them up or kick them when they're down or, like,
or tie them up or strain them. Yeah. Anything.
Yeah.
This is the same one with episode one where Burnham was just happily blasting people into nothingness. It's the same thing. It's we're going to action movie territory. The death toll isn't five or six people every episode. We're not doing it right.
And they've already established that Saru has Spock-like strength in the episode where they're trying to save the Pavans. He's almost about to kill Bonham with his bare hands. Like, he's using his legs. He's kicking her. He's throwing her around like a ragdoll. He has higher strength than a human being does. They should have negated that with either having someone restrain him, tie him up, or anything. So it's just like, I'm standing here, and I'm the largest guy in the room with the greatest reach with my legs, which they've already established. Like, he can run super fast. Yeah. I hated it. I'm sorry. I just hated it.
Okay, so let's talk about the ice. Abe, you brought it up earlier. What's going on with the ice?
Yeah, exactly. What's going on with the ice? Exactly. It's a plot device to hold a ship down. That's it. And even the threat of, oh, it's going to grow over the ship. There's no even like, oh, we're losing cabin pressure. We're losing snow. Yeah, it's making some creakiness. Well, we better get it done quick then, shall we? There's no kind of idea how it works. There's no idea how this planet has existed with this symbiotic ice thing that crawls over everything. Is the settlement up high up in the sky so ice can't grow in it? I don't get it. I don't understand how it could possibly be there and no one literally fall victim to it every time it's night.
They describe it as a parasite. Is the ice actually an alien? Is that our real first contact, is with the ice alien?
I don't know. It could just be. I mean, technically speaking, it could just be a natural hazard, and they call it that. But what? I mean, the Pirate Pete mentions that it can fit. You know, I've seen it force it down someone's throat. It's like, yeah, you have. But yeah. Then what? You call it a parasite. What does it do? Does it just cover over people and that's it? Is it actual just quick grow? Is it just quick grown ice? Is that all it is? It's weird.
It's weird, Jim.
Well, it's introduced, and again, they introduce it twice. They introduce it with Nothing, the famous Star Trek line of some kind of blank.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
kind of parasitic ice. And if I see that line anywhere again, I'm just gonna shut my remote at the TV. Like I watched the original. I don't need to see it again.
Yeah, once you're a meme, some kind of meme, then that's you can't do that. Yeah,
like just evolve. Like it's a parasitic ice life form. We don't know if it's sentient. We don't know if it's just an environmental thing. We don't know anything about it. It can attack organic and inorganic material. If it's a parasite, it needs something to feed.
Right, right.
Is it just feeding off the lack of sunlight? Like, I think I figured while Aid was going off, I said, I think I figured what Discovery's problem is in the back of my head.
Okay.
It's a collegiate problem. Well, told the Discovery is a science ship, right?
Yep.
But everyone on Discovery is so specialized in their field that they don't have any innate curiosity to look out and explore and ask questions outside of that field. If it's not mushrooms, Stanmans don't give a shit. If it's, if it's not like alien life forms, Bornham's out. Like they're all so highly specialized in their fields that no one's like, this is a parasitic ice. Like, is it alive? Like no one even asks the question, is it alive?
Yeah. Yeah, what does it want?
What does it want? Can we reason with it? Can we talk to it? Like, no one's a generalist to be posing these questions. And I'm just sitting here, like, screaming, why aren't you guys curious about your situation?
Yeah, if this was a Next Gen episode, right? If it was a shuttle crew that was stuck on a planet and the ice was going on, they'd go, right, what does it want? Well, it's obviously trying to get into the engines or something. It's trying to engine. Right, can we somehow overload the engine so we give it enough energy so it backs away? Right. Can we do something else? Can we give it a heartburn or something? There would be something like that. No, we just rip the thing out of the ship. That's all we're going to do. We're just going to take off. There's no exploration. There's no kind of, right, how do we get out of this problem thing? So we're too busy in the saloon getting, kung-fuing people.
And earlier in the episode, you at the very beginning, you described this as going very Firefly, like a Western in space, even with the doors, the saloon doors that open up.
Exactly.
I had not thought about this as a Western, but you're right. It's a classic saloon. I mean, I think the guy's even like wiping the bar.
He is,
when they come in. Jim, you've written a lot about Westerns. You've thought about this a lot. Run us through this episode as a Western.
Okay. It's only a Western in three scenes. And all those scenes are taking place in the ball. And it's just the classic, the white hats show up 5 minutes before the black hat shows up.
Yeah.
Enough to get the lay of the land, to get some information as to what these people are dealing with. The black hat show up, and then the white hat immediately is like, yes, I'll go to my ship and we'll get you 130 pieces of dilithium that you can then use to like haunt more people. Like, that's the thing. Like, he's negotiating with the bad guy who just killed the guy who's named after Superman.
One of our audience members, Don, just noted that Pirate Pete even has spurs on his boots, which I had not noticed.
He did. He jangled as he walked. He didn't.
In the background, the making of, like, the director talks about this, and he's so, like, so excited that he brought dust into Star Trek.
Oh wow!
And I'm just thinking, well, Star Trek is a Western in the TOS. Those several Western episodes,
peppered
throughout the show. Like, you can easily do that. This show only does it for about 15 to 20 minutes of its runtime, and its runtime. Like, if you're going to do a Western, you have to paste it more deliberately than the way this episode's paced.
Yeah.
Like, Western as action movies tend to be the Magnificent Seven remake, and no one's going to rewatch that film.
This is what's annoying about it. Like, so we've got Pirate Pete and his, what, three guys, four guys that come through?
Something like that.
that they seem to literally be the only people, because there's no mention of like, oh, well, we've got a ship above you, we're going to blow crap out of it. Seems to be five guys, right?
Yeah.
How many people in this settlement? Nobody mentions. Are there just those three guys left? Are they 25 people here? Because they seem to want an awful lot of dilithium for ships, technology, da-da-da-da-da-da. Why do they all just pile into that bar and kick the crap out of them? Again, it's just, it's such a weird kind of thing where they
got one set and they were going to use it.
Yeah.
I don't like to poke at plot holes personally, because I kind of feel like the writers are trying to say something with the story, and it doesn't really bother me when the plot doesn't make a lot of sense. But it was really hard in this episode because Saru and Tilly have phasers. The people in the bar, at least a couple of them, have guns. They know where Pirate Pete's going to show up. Why don't they just all line up and, you know, like, yeah, you're done here, mister. Turn around and go home. It's the simplest solution. And they don't even have to kill him. They could just stun him if fighting broke out. I don't like to, you know, hindsight the plot like that, because I feel like the writers are trying to say something and the story that they have is trying to do something, and I'm trying to figure out what that is. But I just didn't like what it was saying. I don't like the thing that the story is saying.
Mm-hmm. Those. So I don't actually have a problem pointing out plot holes. Like,
yeah,
plot hole, like my favorite Star Trek movie is the one where they go in the center of the galaxy and they meet God. Like, I can live with a plot hole.
Yeah.
I just need people to act consistently. And I think one of the problems with this episode is it's so concerned with either being Firefly or The Mandalorian, where it tells a whole story in one episode, that it forgets it's Star Trek. And I think one of the things that could have helped this episode is I needed a captain's log. I needed something from Saru's point of view, because the captain's log just isn't a vehicle for exposition, because they delivered their exposition,
right,
to the extent that they were interested in said exposition. But I needed it to explain like Saru's thought process or what he's trying to accomplish, because he's already made a deal with the Sentinels to give them dilithium, and now he's making a second deal with this guy who killed their only friend in this establishment.
Yeah.
Like I need to know where Saru's head is at in terms of like making these decisions. I don't need him second guessing himself, but I need something a little bit more from him as a captain to get behind him.
Did they even do captain's logs in this guy? Right?
That was actually exactly my question.
Yeah.
They have done, Bonham has done like two or three different logs. So the voiceover narrative of someone giving a log entry is established in Discovery.
Yeah, because Next Gen, obviously, every episode, Next Gen would be always the captain's log. We're here to do a sign that, yeah, and it'll give you the exposition straight away. We all knew what was going on. We didn't have to have the scene because we were told what was happening. That was fine. But I think this is almost a similar thing with like, we're not doing it because we did the Next Generation, so we're not going to do it. It's like trying to get rid of the James Bond gun barrel. It's like, we're not going to do the gun barrel. We've had it for so long. I'm going to be the one that changes it. And everyone goes, where's the gun barrel? It's like, so the idea of they're not using that as a storytelling technique. It's a fundamental part of Star Trek. Such a weird, yeah.
And Lowell Dex uses it.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Everyone's making a private log on that show.
So then Burnham shows up and saves the ship, and we find out it's been a year. Jim, you look like you're going to die.
I hate this. I don't want to be that guy. Like, I want to be like the guy who's super excited and super happy about Star Trek. That's the person I want to be.
Right.
But DC Comics, to backtrack, they did Infinite Crisis, right? And it was the like 2005 big event, and it was going to 2006 big event. It was going to reshape the DC universe forever. It lasted a couple years. And after the comic, every book jumped 1 year later. Everyone had a new costume. Everyone had a new look, or they had a new viewpoint in life. And then the series, you know, 52 went in and like told every week of that story.
Yep.
We're not going to get 52 to explain what Michael Bonham has been doing to the point where she now has a starship. Like, that was a plot point in the last episode, was there's only two Federation ships flying around, and now she has a ship strong enough to pull out the Discovery from ice, from being swallowed by a planet. she now has she has an upgrade. She's got a new outlook on life. Now it gives more credence to her being a captain because she has a year of experience that we'll never get to see. Like, if the next episode is like a day, like a year in the life of Bonham in this new future, I'll take back every criticism I'm levying at this episode. But when that happened, when Bonham showed up, when they started talking about like there was a ship coming and they saw it building it up like it's a reveal, I knew that the moment they saw it building it up like it was a reveal, I was like, oh, fuck, it's just going to be Bonham saving the day. And I don't mind Bonham saving the day. I think she should save the day in certain cases. But it was just, I didn't need it now.
Yeah.
I wanted the crew to be like, okay, we survived this together by doing the thing that we said we were going to do, which was lean on each other. We've escaped. Now let's go find Bonham. And even if they find Bonham in the next 2 minutes of the next episode, I would have been fine with that.
Yes, this is what I was hoping they're not going to do. I was hoping they weren't going to do the this is the Burnham episode, this is the crew episode, this is the Burnham, and do that for 8 of the 10 episodes or 13 episodes we've got, and then they're going to get to the end of it. So if we do go back to that Burnham year of whatever, we're going to have an entire episode with no crew. So again, we're going to not see all these plot points that we've just seen in this episode brought up. We've got another week to come along. I personally can see the year of Burnham being a novel. That's what's going to happen with it. They're going to fill it all in with that, and they're going to allude to it, and that'll be it, and that's all we see. But the idea, I think, if they shift back and forth, it's going to become like, well, you know, you're going to turn people off because it's like, well, I like Saru. I'm not particularly a Burnham fan. Right, I can skip every other episode, and it's not going to make a difference till they come together, and then I'll scar, I can make it up, whatever. So I'm hoping they don't do that.
So if Star Trek Discovery Season 3 is a post-apocalyptic story, there's a certain kind of arc that a post-apocalyptic story has. And there's the wake up, when you wake up in the post-apocalyptic world, or when you pick up our characters in the post-apocalyptic. Maybe it's right after the apocalypse has happened. And the characters are sort of figuring out what the world is like, and they're exploring, and the struggle is simply to survive. The world is so harsh that you're just trying to stay alive. That's the main part. And then you encounter like other groups that have formed, and maybe there's a kind of authority that's created itself, and you have to negotiate with that authority. And eventually you get to a rebuilding phase where you decide to rebuild your society. And maybe you have come to terms with some of those other government, some of those authorities, some of those other settlements. Maybe you've joined with them, you've built them together, others have become permanent enemies, but that what we have just done now with the 1 year later is we have skipped the entire first phase of that. The whole survival part of the story, where we're just trying to keep alive from one episode to the next. Well, now that's not a problem anymore. We've skipped all those stories. And it's a shame, because it seems to me like there's a lot of good stories there. I presume that the writers either decided that the audience didn't want to see that. They didn't want to watch the Star Trek bridge crew simply trying to survive and gather information. Notice that the whole mystery of what's going on in the universe is now no longer a mystery, because Burnham's figured all that shit out over a year. And we're just going to get tons of exposition at the beginning of the next episode where she tells everybody, okay, here's what the burn is, here's how it happened, here's where the Federation is, here's what's left of it, like the exchange is X, Y, and Z. All of those questions that we have had, Burnham's got answers to those things by now. There's no reasonable way for her to not have answers to those things by now.
Well, the other thing as well, at the end of episode one, we got the best part of episode one where we get the guy who's been sitting at the desk for 4 years. And now it's like, oh, he's been a Federation starship personnel for a year. Oh, well, that's kind of worn off the excitement of that then, isn't it? He's just been, he's been flying. So it's like, do we not see him step his first step on the spaceship? Do we not see him like fly away from his system for the first time? No,
he's on a uniform.
As far as I'm concerned, that year that we just skipped is the Star Trek Discovery game campaign I want to run. and somebody plays Burnham and somebody plays Book, and you can't play the bridge crew because we haven't found them yet. They're not here yet. And somebody plays the new communications chief, and we rebuild, we go from episode one to episode two, and we take 24 game sessions to do it. That's such a great plot. Why would you skip all that? That's so much good shit.
So this is my feel. So, you know, I watched the you know, in next week in Discovery preview.
Yes, we heard that.
We don't get those in the UK. We just get an episode. That's it.
Oh, okay. So they sort of tease out that she hasn't figured out what the bone is, because there was a line that Tilly says, "You're going to figure this out."
Okay.
My feel is that we're going to figure out what caused the bone.
Yeah.
And then Bonham's going to go back in time and reboot it.
No.
I'm really afraid that that's going to be the deviating step, and that's why Discovery has to wait 1,000 years in place, because the crew, they go through a doorway and they can't take the ship with them.
God, I hope you're wrong.
I hope I'm wrong too, because here's the thing: like, the moral implications of this.
Yeah.
Star Trek has always been you can go back in time and fix something. If someone else has gone back in time and fucked it up.
Right, yes.
McCoy goes back in time, saves Edith Kilo. Edith Kilo then, you know, delays FDR entering World War II, and the Nazis win. You go back in time, and Edith Kilo must die. Like, that's the way Star Trek has always played those sort of morality.
Yeah.
Like, we don't get a do-over for Trump. We don't get to go back in time make sure that the Electoral College doesn't do what the Electoral College is going to do. We don't get those do-overs in life. So the idea that even the promise of maybe going back in time and fixing it because we don't like it, like, that upset me just with that teaser going, oh, I really don't want them to do this. I want to be wrong. I want to be 100% wrong. I want to be like, okay, Federation got fucked up, but we're going to rebuild the Federation. We're going to do it like what you said two episodes ago. We're going to do it better.
Yeah.
We're going to do it so that there's no evil Starfleet admiral. We're going to do it so that there's less bureaucracy and there's more people interaction. Like, that's what I want. And I'm afraid that we're going to sort of like, this is going to be a giant Voyager episode and we have a reset button at the very end of it to get us more Federation stories.
The thing is that writers know that that's a terrible cheat, that it's a shell game. When it's like having the characters wake up and the whole season was a dream. It's a terrible cheat, and it makes the audience feel like they've been ripped off. They get really invested in these characters, are invested in the story, and then you make all that shit not matter. That's a terrible move, and the writers know it's a terrible move. So I'm hoping that they don't do that.
This is the thing. This we episode one, we established time travel technology or theory has been banned since 150 years previously. So they've acknowledged the fact. Now, whether or not that's so that they can inspire Burnham to, like, well, I'm going to go and do it. I'm going to go and find it myself anyway, even though it's banned, and kind of make it that forbidden holy grail that she can kind of like reactivate to do that, exactly what you're saying. But Pirate Pete knows what time travel looks like. Well, it's chronotons. It must be time travel then. You go, what? How do you know that?
Yeah,
it's somewhere out there. There's either time travel going on, even though it's technically been banned, or it's just part of the Federation or the whatever database they're using. I don't know.
My other point is, this is not called The Hope Is You Part 2. Right. This episode was called Far From Home. So there's going to be a Part 2. My hope is that season 4 doesn't open with The Hope Is You Part 2. And we've just rebuilt the universe to fit all Image. Because there was another episode later this season called Unification Part 3, which apparently may be picking up from the Spock point, you know, the Spock TNG crossover.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a weird thing that they said. They mentioned something about, oh, she's going to find out what happened to Spock. And you go, well, he disappeared off to a mirror universe. Oh, she doesn't know that. And it's like, what, are you actually going to acknowledge that? Is this going to be a thing?
I mean, if it gives us Kelvin, like Chris Pine shows up for a cameo, I'd be okay with that. I would be okay with that.
Yeah.
We can't have William Shatner show up, but we can still have Captain Kirk show up for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, anything that we have missed that you guys want to bring up, Aiden?
I honestly do not know where we are going with this season. Like you say, we've got potential to the original concept when we talked about this before the season tide started. right, we're starting from scratch. We're doing day one. We're going to rebuild the Federation. We're going to, and it, they don't seem to have done that in three episodes. They've fought some people in a bar and they've fought some ice. That's about as far as you got. So I don't know. I don't know if we've got this grand plan anymore. At least we haven't seen those inklings of this is the big bad of the season. So I don't know what's going to happen. I have no clue what's going to happen in this one.
Well, that can be good, right? It can be good to not.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Jim?
So right now, for season three, we're at 50-50. Like, this can go one or two ways for me. And I was super high on like, we talked about the communications office. So,
yeah.
Like, Twiddle lost their shit over this guy.
Nice.
And I think it's a lot has to do with people identifying with him, being a guy who's stuck in one room, yeah, who's doing this thing, who's a true believer, like all of us Trekkies all, and in living in this COVID nightmare. Like, if they write him off as to have died in that last year, oh my God, can you imagine the shitstorm that's going to happen?
I went back after I watched the second episode, Far From Home. I went back and I rewatched just the framing sequence to the first episode. And God damn it, he made me cry again.
Really good Star Trek.
Like, he's good.
It wears its heart on its sleeve, and it doesn't apologize for that. And it's beautiful for that. And that's Discovery at its best. And I feel like this episode is Discovery at its worst.
Now, I have a question. After Jim mentioned the opening credits, I took a more careful look at them. And, of course, you're absolutely right. They're always very informative and instrumental in the season to come. Lots of shows are doing this now, where they have different elements of the opening credits that hint at what you're about to get. I spent more time than I care to admit analyzing the Westworld opening credits for all three seasons. Do those robots that we see, those like floating robots, yeah, with the Starfleet symbol, are those in the show already, or is that something we have not yet seen?
Those are in the show already. We've seen them. They show up in the last episode of season two.
They pop up and they fly around the outside. Mm-hmm.
And also they have the little Star Trek short, the animated one, which had like a little dot drone competing with the tardigrade for the babies.
I haven't seen that one yet. Okay.
It's cute. It's adorable. It's directed by the guy who does all the music for like The Incredibles, okay, and the Star Trek movies. It's well worth the watch, yeah, because they have giant Abraham Lincoln.
Don, one of our audience members just asked if those are exocomps. Those aren't exocomps, right? Because we've seen the exocomp. It doesn't look any, unless it's a different version of the exocomp.
No, they're not exocomps. They're something new. In fact,
exocomps get a major time on screen in Lower Decks with
Peanut Hamper.
Yeah, what was her name again?
Peanut Hamper.
Peanut Hamper. Peanut Hamper, the exocomp. So, Don, watch Lower Decks, and you'll see an exocomp. But we're going to have to make those robots have to be coming back. Those, obviously, they're important because they have we get some shots of them in the opening credits. And I saw lots and lots of dilithium crystals in the opening credits again. So, which leads me to the thing that's been lurking in the back of my head since the first episode. We haven't really gotten into this much, but I think you mentioned it last week. We have a problem. Dilithium is rare, doesn't exist, or is damaged. We have a solution to that problem. We know in the past that alien princess, I forget her name, has a way of recrystallizing dilithium.
They have that device on the Discovery. They use it to power up the time crystal.
Okay, so.
I wonder if that's why they were so free with giving it away, because we just nicked some more out. I don't know. Anyway, carry on, sorry.
This is a Chekhov's gun situation, right? I don't think they have to go back in time to fix everything. I think that they'll use the technology that they established in season, in the Short Trek, to fix the dilithium problem, and they'll use that to bring to pacify the galaxy. Yeah, right? Is that the obvious play? Is that the taking the gun off the mantelpiece?
Again, oddly enough though, if that is the case,
yeah,
no one mentioned it again. Burnham doesn't go, damn, if I'd have known, I've got a device on Discovery that can do just what you're looking for. We can get, I just gotta find Discovery for that reason.
Well,
and when they say, "Oh, we need stuff," oh, don't we? We've got a ship that can do that. We've got something on our ship that can do that. He talks about trading dilithium, but he doesn't talk about something we can do. So I don't know. I think they might have forgotten. To be honest,
I had forgotten that they had the machine on the ship. I knew that secret was out there. So I'm okay with them not talking about it yet, because when it happens, they'll say, "Well, why didn't you mention this before?" And she'll say, "Well, because we didn't have the ship before, so it didn't matter." Like they'll, you know, she'll come up with an explanation for why she never mentioned it. But that seems to be the obvious fix to the problem. It's kind of like if we were in a Mad Max setting and we find the oil refinery, right, from Road Warrior. Like, okay, here's the solution to our lack of gasoline. We have an oil refinery.
Well, your point to Mad Max, they do that in the most recent one. They find the Waddle, right? They open up the aqueducts at the very end of that last movie, the Fury Road movie, which was so good.
So good. Because
it's Mel Gibson. Yeah. And it wasn't about him, which made it even better.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much the recrystallizing technology is going to be referenced. They could just be like, oh, it's short-circuited in the time jump.
Do you think they'd do that? My point of view is the opposite. That, as you know, I've been arguing since last week that this is what the Star Trek writers wanted to do all along. And I think that of all of the things that the princess could have invented,
true,
why did she invent recrystallizing dilithium? The answer? For this, for season three. She invented it so that they could have it in season two, so that they could use it in season three.
But does that mean all we're going to get from these episodes onwards is Discovery come knocking on the door? Need a dilithium, Governor? Got some in the back here. You want some? And they're going to become like the new courier service or something? Is that going to be all we're going to see, jumping from civilization to civilization, giving away dilithium goodies to people? I don't know.
Here's my thinking.
Go ahead, Jim.
Here's my thinking, Jason. I think they're going to solve the device, and here's why. If they are actually going to have a reunification between Spock and Bonham later in the show, that is Ethan Peck and old man Spock makeup, if that's the plot of Unification Part 3, Spock recrystallizes dilithium in Star Trek 4 with radiation.
That's true. He does.
That's the whole plot point. That's why Chekhov gets the head injury. So future Spock, if we're going to meet future Spock in some way, shape, or form, he's going to have that knowledge.
I don't think we're meeting future Spock.
And another thing as well, just as an aside.
Sure.
Saru got hold of a personal transporter.
Yes.
That apparently they can they're so prevalent that you can just give them away to a stranger that comes walking through your door. Oh, I have a personal transporter. That's fine. That is going to show up at some point, obviously, as a plot point. That's going to bug me.
How does it work? If we saw a book, he pulls up the hologram and he's hitting cold in there. And this, we're handed this device, and it's like, is it locked? Like, how did the Nemesis transporter work that Picard beams onto the bridge? Is it just locked into a certain location?
Yeah.
Like, is it a one-time use?
Okay.
I'm coming on your side, Aid. I don't like it.
You're thinking about it too hard. That's like asking, how come every time I touch my badge, I'm always talking to the exact person I want to talk to? Right? Like,
technical manual says voice recognition.
Riker 2 so and so. I think it just
exactly. And it patches it through. Yeah. Come on, read the books.
I know. All right. If I were the bridge crew and Saru comes in with a personal transporter, I'd be figuring out how we can make one for everybody. That's what the players are like. Okay, I want one of those gizmos. Like, how do I get that? Right.
Yeah, and we presume that the guy he followed right at the beginning had a personal transporter to transport to the, or at least there's some kind of thing going on there. Maybe a transport gate or something like that. But again, it seems to be a short hop. We are not talking planetary hops. We are talking, you know, hundreds of feet or whatever. And again, another reason why we don't even really know where that's at. How did Georgia get up there? How did she happen to wander into that same fecking valley where the transporter was? It's just like, this is nuts. This makes no sense. It makes no more sense. This is even more annoying now.
We did not like this episode, gang. And hopefully next week we have another episode directed by Jonathan Frakes, which will be better.
I would love to see that. Yeah, you're right. And we will not be echoing Galaxy Quest. When this episode was badly written. So I did not know that John Frakes is doing the next one. That's good. Do we have a title for the next episode?
It's The People of Earth.
The People. I think we're going to Earth. We saw that shot of Tilly hugging a tree. So I think we're going back to Earth, which will answer a lot of AIDS questions about what's going on Earth.
Yeah.
My money is on that Earth is abandoned. I don't think there's any people on Earth at all. That's my hunch. But we'll see. Tune in next week on another exciting Space Force, and I hope that we all like this one, or at least one of us does, because this is a tough one. This is a tough vlog. Thanks, guys. Live long and prosper. Ha ha ha.